Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to Behind the Curtain with Paul Listick, our weekly podcast, even being done in this age of the pandemic. And I'm very excited about the show I'm about to do because I have watched my next guest in a variety of contexts, not only on MSNBC, where she is a legal analyst, but actually we go back farther than she even knows, because back when she was executive director of the American Bar Association years ago, I was a regular presenter there and all of that. So we have a history that I remember, and I'm sure she doesn't, but it's my pleasure to welcome to the podcast the author of The Watergate Girl, My Fight for Truth and Justice Against a Criminal President, and we're not talking about Donald Trump, Jill Weinbergs. Jill, thank you. I appreciate you joining me.
Paul, thank you so much for having me on your show and for all the shared background that we have.
We do. Both grew up in Skokie and all of that. We'll talk about that over coffee one day. I do want to start. We're going to talk about the book, but we're in a time where we have just lost Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We don't yet know who the replacement's going to be. That's coming in a couple of days. Most of us could probably guess who it's likely to be. But let me just ask, for as a lawyer, as somebody with your experience, your reaction to the loss of Justice Ginsburg, and no matter who President Trump picks, and we pretty much know the list, what does it mean for the future of the court?
Well, in terms of the loss of Justice Ginsburg, it's, of course, a tragedy for the court and for her family and for all of the people who so admired her, men and women. But I would have to say, especially women who she inspired by her being a phenomenal role model. And it's not just that she was a pioneer in law. It's that she was a pioneer, period, and that she fought for equality for all people, that she was someone who spoke the truth. I even have a Jill's pin that says, "Speak the Ruth," because she had a unique way of speaking and talking and trying to persuade, and she always worked to move forward in a way that people would follow, not just, you know, be out there crazy, but to really persuade people of the righteousness of her position. So it's a real loss. I did teach at Columbia at the same time she did, so I'm one of the honored people who got to, you know, meet and know her even slightly. I certainly wasn't friends, but just getting to know her was wonderful. She also is a graduate of my alma mater, Columbia Law School. And as I hear her story, it's not that different than mine. I hope it's very different than the graduates of Columbia in 2020. But I would like them to take note that there are still hurdles and obstacles that need to be addressed. And following her example of how to do it, which is, again, trying to do it sometimes with humor so that you get the job done instead of just making people angry. I think it's a real loss to have her voice on the court at this time, which brings us to the second half of your question, which is what does it mean for the court? Well, I would say it obviously means that the court will now be a 6-3 extreme right court. We as Americans cannot trust to fairly evaluate because it's become so politicized under this president. Whereas in the past, you had judges who talked to each other, listened to each other, and tried to find the common legal interpretation. I don't think that's going to happen in the future. I think healthcare for Americans is very much at risk. I think, obviously, the right of women's choice is at risk. And so there are a number of issues coming up. The election is at risk. And we're going to have a very different court looking at it than we would have had she not passed in such an untimely way.
Just one follow-up to all of this, which is we're seeing an outpouring from the country in a way we have not seen it for previous justices. And I mean, my proof of that is simply that she's being laid out in front of the Supreme Court for 2 days, not just one. She's going to be the first woman ever to lie in state at the Capitol. Clearly, this has been a tremendous impact for people all over the country. And I know, you know, I follow social media, so I know people, you know, said, well, people were very upset about Justice Scalia's death, too. I grant that. I grant all of that. But it just seems different about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I'm curious whether you think as a court goes on and they deal with the health care battle or other battles that come up, is there a recognition from justices for this legacy that a new justice, the seat that she will fill? Or is there a sense of going, that chapter is closed and now let's get on with our business?
I think that Justice Ginsburg is a folk hero in a way that no Supreme Court justice has ever been. The fact that she has a nickname, the notorious RBG, the fact that there are books written about her, the fact that there is a biopic and a documentary about her, both of which are extraordinarily readable, watchable and enjoyable, makes her passing different. Others are admired, as is she, but she was loved in addition to being admired. And there just was something about her character, both as a litigator before she went on the bench and then as a jurist on the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia and on the Supreme Court. But there is no such thing as a seat that belongs to somebody. So the president will fill it with whoever he chooses, and it will be that person's seat. There's no one probably who could actually, you know, fill her seat, but the candidates that are on the list so far are actually polar opposites of her viewpoint. So that will be a dramatic shift in the court. And with the loss of Scalia and Justice Ginsburg, the dialogue that existed across opposite points of view may disappear, and that would be a shame for the legacy of the court.
Agreed. Let's talk about the Watergate girl. You know, I said when I read the full title and I said my fight for truth and justice against a criminal president, look, there's so many books coming out on a daily basis about President Trump. I felt the need to say this is not about President Trump. But I read this book first earlier in the year. We were supposed to do this interview and the pandemic got in the way. But as I went back to it now, Jill, I thought to myself, it had a whole different impact on me, which is to say, I lived through the history of Watergate, as did you. You worked it. But at the same time, when I look at what the country is going through now, it is an incredible reflection of a time that we're in, yet very different, with seemingly very different results.
It is similar in that you can certainly compare the conduct of the two presidents and the personalities of the two presidents and the people they surrounded themselves with. But it's very different. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is the media environment has changed dramatically. During Watergate, we had three major networks, NBC, ABC, CBS. That was it. There was no cable. There was no Fox. There was no Breitbart. There was no MSNBC. And all the networks and all the newspapers agreed on the facts. They did not dispute facts. They did not claim there are alternative facts. And just think logically, a fact is a fact. There's no alternative to it. There are alternative policies that may result from the facts. One person may want one thing for it, another. But the fact is still the fact. And that's not true anymore. The people who listen to MSNBC get what I believe are the facts. They reflect what I'm seeing, what I'm reading. The people on Fox News are getting a completely different set of information, and they who listen to that believe that that's the fact. So how do you have a debate or discussion with someone who does not accept the facts that you believe are facts? It's very, very, very hard. So that's one big difference. And if Fox News had existed, the outcome of Watergate might have been different, too. The result of this sort of factual gap is also that there's no bipartisanship. And that's because of the facts, but also because of political gerrymandering, which has been allowed. And so a district is so narrowly drawn that a representative does not have to, and actually probably can't, compromise because his constituent or her constituents believe one thing so fervently, they will never accept a compromise. And that's what's led to what I would consider complete gridlock in Congress, is that there's no compromise left. In Watergate, there was bipartisan agreement on articles of impeachment, for example. It was the Republican leadership that went to President Nixon after we released the final, what was known as the smoking gun tape, and I hope we can, you know, get into some of that. And it was the Republicans who went to him and said, we've seen the facts. If you don't resign, you will be convicted in the trial in the Senate. That was before the full impeachment had even happened. Three articles of impeachment had been voted by the committee. It hadn't even gone to the full floor of the House. And it was the Republicans who said, you have to resign. So that would never happen now. You can see what's happening with even going back to Justice Ginsburg, with McConnell saying in 2016, you can't appoint anyone in the election year. And now saying, while voting is already underway, which it is right now, we're going to have a vote on a new nominee. We will fill that position. And in the history of America, there's never been a confirmation in the time right before the election. There have been appointments in January to July of an election year. There has never been one after July. There have been vacancies, but no president, well, one president did nominate someone, and it was rejected, in part because it was an election year. The other three never even nominated someone.
You know, it's interesting that in your epilogue of the book, you tackle sort of this. I know you started writing this a year or more ago when we were in the middle of kind of the Mueller situation. And I have a feeling your book was meant to be a reflection of those days. And so much has happened since then. But you write in the epilogue of the book, you talk about how, in fact, if Watergate, if we had the situation now like Fox News today, as we did in Watergate Day, you would have seen Rosemary Woods going on TV saying you stole the tape and you were the one that knew it exonerated him and that's why you wanted to hide it. I mean, it's a reality change that is so different today that again, as you write in the book, Watergate would have come out very differently if it happened today.
I really do believe that. You know, I started the book actually in 2008 when I theoretically retired and finally had time to write the book. My retirement has clearly failed because, you know, I have a new role at MSNBC, but it was then that I started. I didn't get really busy on it until maybe a few years ago. And I hoped I would portray a time when democracy worked, when there was bipartisan dialogue, when justice prevailed, and you know, during Watergate, justice prevailed. A criminal president was forced from office. The impeachment process didn't go full steam ahead because he recognized what the outcome would be, and he resigned in respect of the Constitution, in respect of democracy, in respect of the opinion of American citizens. It was also a time when public reaction influenced the outcome. Let me point specifically to one example, which is when the Saturday Night Massacre happened, which was October 20th, when President Nixon, faced with court decisions that he would have to turn over the tapes we had subpoenaed, said, I will not turn them over, and ordered his attorney general to fire Archie Cox, who was the special prosecutor. The attorney general, being a man of extreme character and integrity, said, there is no cause. I promised Congress when I was confirmed that I would only fire the special counsel for cause. I will not do it. So, of course, he was out. The deputy attorney general became the acting. He was ordered to fire Cox, and he said the same thing. And so he was out. The third in command at Justice, who was the solicitor general, Robert Bork, became the acting, and he carried out the order. The public reaction was so severe that 3 days after that happened, on October 23rd, Richard Nixon announced that he would appoint a new special prosecutor and that he would turn over the tapes. So in 3 days, and this is in the days before email, people actually put pen to paper and sent in through the U.S. Post Office, which still actually delivered mail on time. They delivered millions of pieces of mail to the White House and to our office saying, this is wrong, you can't do this. And that's what caused the turnaround in 3 days. And it was that decision to turn over the tapes that was really a big break for us. But it led to ultimately a hearing because after saying he would turn over the 9 tapes we had subpoenaed, the White House announced, well, except for 2 that are missing, they weren't recorded. And we had a hearing on whether that was nefarious or just, you know, truly an accident. And then, in a very bad display of trial tactics, just on the eve of Halloween, they announced, oops, there's a third problem. There's one that has an 18 and a half minute gap where there should be conversation. And we can find no innocent explanation. Only Rosemary Woods, who was Nixon's assistant, his secretary, only she can explain it. And that was what led to, I think, a real break in public opinion saying, this is wrong. This is clearly criminal. Because when I cross-examined her, her story fell apart. And there were pictures of her trying to do what she said she did to cause the accidental erasure that proved that it was not an accidental erasure. And it really turned public opinion even further than the October 20th Saturday Night Massacre. So things were happening very quickly. That one happened right after Thanksgiving. So we're talking about a period from October 20th to the end of November where so much was happening and happening fast.
You know, I want to also let people know that, I mean, first of all, the book is a great read. It is very conversationally written. It's not this dry history of what happened. But what I also love about it, maybe especially for people like me who are just, you know, such fans of your work, we learn about you. The book has sex. It has no sex. It has. I mean, there's some stuff in the way you, I know that part of the promotion of the book is to say we learned some secrets about you. So I'm not going to give them away. But having said that, I mean, you work your life into this, which is so important because not only were you working on the case, but you were going through your life. You can't put that aside when you're telling the story.
Well, that's how I felt. I will say that many of my Watergate colleagues, a few of whom I shared a draft of the book with, said, you cannot do this. Don't do this. And I said, you know, first of all, it's honest. Second of all, I've always believed as a trial lawyer that you have to be authentic, and this is part of my authentic story. But most importantly, aside from wanting to show how justice can work, how democracy can work, I feel that there are many, particularly women, in my situation who will benefit from hearing this story. And if I can help anyone by sharing my own insecurities and my own problems in marriage, then maybe others will benefit. I know I've always loved, my favorite form of writing has always been memoir and autobiography and biography, because by reading about how other people encounter obstacles, hurdles, problems, and overcome them is how you learn different strategies for approaching things. And this is certainly not written as a how-to book, But I do hope that people reading it will see the many different strategies I took to the many obstacles I faced. I mean, sexism, which hadn't risen to the level of sexual assault, but was basically discrimination, it was rampant when I was in school. And again, going back to Justice Ginsburg, who graduated from Columbia 9 years before me, my class was a quota of 5% female and 5% African-American. That was, you know, how it was. So we were very few. We were also, you know, in the same way she was asked by the dean at Harvard before she transferred to Columbia, justify your being in this class. Well, when I started law school, it was during Vietnam, and I was asked, why are you here? You're taking the place of a man who should be here and who will die in Vietnam because you took his rightful place. Now, talk about being justified in feeling like an outsider. I think I came to understand myself much better as I read the book, as I wrote the book, because when I had to decide what stories go in and what don't, and I was just jotting down an outline, I found that so many of the stories I wanted to share involve sexism in some way, such as that one, such as questions during interviews. What kind of birth control do you use? Are you planning to have children? What would you do if you were in the middle of a dinner party and a client had a problem? Questions that no man would ever be asked were common for us, and it wasn't illegal back then, so we had to answer them. When I met Jeb Magruder, who was one of our key witnesses for the first time, it was with Jim Neal, who was the senior lawyer on the trial team, and George Frampton, who was a junior lawyer on the team. And when Jim offered coffee, Jeb Magruder and his lawyer both turned to me and said, I'll take mine black. They assumed that if I was there, I was the secretary. And Jim Neal spoke up and said, George Frampton got up to get the coffee, and then Jim said, not very smart, insulting the person who's going to be negotiating your plea deal. And so I had support from my colleagues in the office, but there are many examples in the book. Judge Sirica made several comments that were horrifying, and the students at Columbia actually ended up, after the second one, writing him a letter, and he apologized to me. So, you know, these were real things. Headlines referred to me as the mini-skirted lawyer. My news articles would say, today wearing, and it would describe what I was wearing, Jill did the following in court. No man would be described as Richard Benveniste, today wearing a blue blazer, questions so-and-so, but these were real things that we had to overcome. And so I found ways to overcome them, to get my first trial against the odds, to do whatever needed to be done, to do what I wanted to do. And I just heard today a quote from Ruth Bader Ginsburg about, you know, you should always do what you want to do, but do it in a way that others will follow. And I think that's really good advice, because you want to set an example and open doors for other people as well.
And just a couple of minutes left, and I love you just telling the story. By the way, George Frampton, I remember when I first read the book, I looked this up. He went on to be a professor at U of I, right? I think I had him for class.
No, well, George Frampton's father was a professor at U of I. George Frampton, my George Frampton, has always been a practicing lawyer. He's had an amazing career at the Council of Environmental Quality, at wildlife and wilderness organizations, and he had just come from a Supreme Court clerkship to be on the Watergate team, and is a fabulous human being.
Gotcha.
Wonderful, smart person.
Yeah.
So he's from Champaign, Illinois. So he's from our alma mater.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So let me, as we wrap, let me just say for people, I recommend everybody, I just love The Watergate Girl, My Fight for Truth and Justice Against a Criminal President, full title by Jill Winebanks. But final question, Jill, should people read this because they should gain a better understanding about Watergate? Should they read it because they should gain a better understanding of what women deal with in the practice, because it was you and a bunch of young men on that team? Or should they read it because we're in the time of Donald Trump and it's something to reflect back on given our current situation?
Hopefully all three, and one more, which you mentioned earlier. It's because it is a fast and fun read, but I think those three reasons that you've given are all equally true. And I did write it as if I was talking to friends. I'm very open and honest in it. And I learned from speaking to large groups that the best way of communicating is just to talk to people. And so it's written in that voice, and I hope people will enjoy it. The reviews have been terrific, and I know as I meet people and sign books, which, of course, I used to sign in person in front of people, but in the world today, I sign book plates that are sent along with the book itself, if people request a customized book. And actually, I can mention here in Chicago, the Bookstall in Winnetka and Bookends and Beginnings in Evanston are both working with me on personalizing books. So if anyone wants them personalized, I recommend those two independent bookstores. So that's how it goes.
Yeah. Actually, I did a book signing at Bookends and Beginnings before all this started. What a great bookstore. These are small independent bookstores people should take advantage
of.
Yeah,
it's wonderful.
But if for whatever reason you're not in that neighborhood or you're somewhere else, then just book. Yes, on the Loeb-Leopold trial.
Exactly.
Yeah. Fascinating. Well, people can read that book if they want to, but what they must read is The Watergate Girl by Jill Winebanks. Again, love your work on MSNBC and everywhere you appear. Final question. I don't know if you're wearing, you talked about a Ruth Bader Ginsburg pin earlier, but are you wearing a pin right now? If so, what is it?
I have a series of Ruth Bader Ginsburg pins that I am wearing since the moment of her death, and I will wear for several more days. I have a Ruth Bader Ginsburg dissent collar necklace, a dissent collar pin, dissent collar earrings, a cartoon of her, sort of a caricature of her face, and a Mount Nasty pin, which features Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Hillary Clinton, Elizabeth Warren, and Michelle Obama. Obviously, we now have to have a new pin created that would add Kamala Harris. And who knows who else, but for sure, she has earned the title because she's been called a nasty woman by the president. And so, we need a new Mount Nasty pin. Someone should design it and I will buy it.
All right. Okay. Jill Winebanks, Happy New Year. Shana Tova to you, and your family. Again, the book is The Watergate Girl. Check it out. Bookstores, Amazon, however you can get it. Thanks for your time. Thanks for your insight. I hope we get to talk again.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv, and hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes, and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.